put into deportation proceedings.
We're going to continue this discussion. Post online at democracynow.org. Mohammad Razvi, founding executive director of Council of Peoples Organizations, community groups serving Muslims, Arabs, and South Asians, as well as Jen Gonerman, will link to your piece in the New Yorker magazine, Fighting for the Immigrants of Little Pakistan. This is Democracy Now! Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Diener, Sam Malkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Tarina Nadura, Andre Lewis. I'm Amy Goodman. Our website is democracynow.org. You can read, see, watch all the shows at Democracy Now!
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Avenue Q, produced by Triangle Productions. The play runs from June 8th through July 1st at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza in Portland. Avenue Q is a musical that tells the story of Princeton, a recent college grad who moves into a shabby New York apartment and meets other residents. Together, they struggle to find jobs, dates, and their ever-elusive purpose in life. Again, that's Avenue Q from June 8th through July 1st at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to be a founding sponsor of the Waterfront Blues Festival, happening June 30th through July 4th from noon to 10 p.m. Single-day passes are now available, as well as the Blues Buddy Pass, the Benefactor Pass, and many other options to enjoy the blues in person. Again, that's the 30th Annual Waterfront Blues Festival, benefit for the Oregon Food Bank. Saturday, June 30th through July 4th, noon to 10 p.m. at Waterfront Park in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm/WBF2017.
It's a little past five, and coming up next, we have KBOO Evening News. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Oregon Education Association has cleared its first hurdle in its effort to have two new tax measures placed in front of voters. Abdulrahman Noura, charged with manslaughter in the death of 15-year-old Fallon Smart on Hawthorne Boulevard and since on bail, is now a fugitive. And Monday evening at Powell's Bookstore in Beaverton, Naomi Klein and KBOO's Joanne Hardesty had a conversation before a live audience. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, June 21st, 2017. I'm Brian Pritchett. KBOO News poet Dan Raphael just realized the world is a buyer's market.
Amazon is buying Whole Foods. The 0.1% bought another congressional seat yesterday. Walmart already owns Arkansas. Soon Apple will buy I-5 and rename it the I-Way. Our governor wants to sell off some state agencies. Our legislature can't pass an infrastructure bill because nobody wants to pay for it, though nobody wants to stop driving. There will be more housing for the houseless when developers can profit from shelters. We'll have more solar power when big business can meter the sun. There's no market for poetry, no market for community. When there's not enough working hours in the day for food and shelter, what do you do? What's not for sale? For Poetic Justice and Summer, this is Dan Raphael.
Abdulrahman Noura, charged with manslaughter in the death of 15-year-old Fallon Smart on Hawthorne Boulevard on August 19th, has fled. Since Oregon judges can only deny bail in cases of murder or treason, the judge set the bail at $1 million, but the Saudi government paid for the $100,000 bond, and he was released with an ankle bracelet on September 19th, which was Fallon Smart's birthday. As Noura has removed his ankle bracelet, his whereabouts are currently unknown. Although police confiscated his Saudi passport, the government's involvement in his case makes it likely that he has received a duplicate. After the accident last August, citizens staged protests and vigils at the site for several days. Although the federal prosecutors may have concluded their investigation of John Kitzhaber and Sylvia Hayes without charges, the former Oregon governor and his fiancée are not quite off the hook yet. The criminal inquiry revolved around payments that Hayes Consulting Company had received from companies attempting to influence state policy. At that time, she was also working as an unpaid advisor to the governor. Yesterday, the Oregon Government Ethics Commission issued a statement saying that they will now review the allegations. They put their initial review on hold in 2015 when the federal investigation began. But now that the federal prosecutors have completed their work, the Ethics Commission will finish the initial review and decide whether to go forward with a full investigation. Oregon Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum has previously said that she has no interest in looking into this matter. Monday evening at Powell's Bookstore in Beaverton, Naomi Klein and KBOO's Joanne Hardesty had a conversation before a live audience. Here are a few samples of that conversation.
And so my question is, since Trump, one of his first duties was to disconnect us from the Paris Treaty, where do we go from here? I mean, clearly we can't wait for the federal government to take an active role in protecting the climate and its people. And so what do we do when, you know, at the national level, it's like, it's not happening.
So I guess we do, but in particular, Portland does what Portland has been doing, right? Which is stop the infrastructure that is required to export the fossil fuels to bring it to market, right? This strategy is more important than ever, and it is also incredibly important to create beacons, right? To show that it is possible to get to 100% renewable energy as quickly as science demands and as technology allows, which fortunately is very quick. You have, you have an ordinance on the books. Is it an ordinance or a
resolution? It is a resolution. Yeah, the city of Portland just passed a 100% renewable resolution. By 2035, all electricity, and by 2050, everything.
Which is one of the most ambitious targets in the country. But, you know, you can have a target and have very little happen, right?
Yes,
so there has to be constant pressure to realize this, to do it in a way that is justice-based. And I'm going to ask you a little bit about that in a minute. But I think, you know, the ethos has to be that, you know, look, some very dangerous people control some very powerful arms of government,
that's right.
But they do not control everything,
right?
They do not, no, they don't control what states do, and they don't control what cities do, they don't control what sovereign tribes do, they do not control what sovereign governments do, right? And so, you know, Michelle Obama had that great line at the Democratic convention where she said, when they go low, we go high. She was talking about tone.
Yes.
I think that should be retrofitted to be about deed, you know, that as they go low, as they go high, as they go rogue, we have to step up.
Yes.
We have to aim higher, right? So however quickly we were transitioning before, we have to redouble our efforts, right? We have to divest our universities from fossil fuels and our city councils, right? Every place where we have power that is not in the hands of the Trumps of this world have to do more, right? So we need to say no, you know, no to the new infrastructure, no to the pipelines and the coal trains and all of it, right? And the export terminals. But we also have to be a beacon of yes, right? Because one of the most powerful things that Trump had going for him still is this lie that the only way to create jobs, the only way to have a healthy economy is through coal, is through pipelines, right? And that is just not true, but we need beacons, we need proof, right? And this city has a great history of providing that kind of leadership.
All over the globe, all of a sudden, fascism seems to be the flavor of the day. And you've had that experience in Canada. That experience has happened, like, all over the place. And And so what is that a reaction to?
So I think it's a combination of factors. I think part of it is just sort of system failure on a bunch of different levels. I don't think white supremacy ever went away.
Yes.
But something is causing it to surge, right? And part of it is just is the license of getting encouragement from at the top. Part of the responsibility for what is happening, in my view, rests with centrist political parties that are not offering real economic alternatives.
That's right.
And providing that kind of visionary leadership. And, you know, I do think we are seeing, you know, we're seeing this kind of toxic combination of, you know, what happens when people lose economic security, which everybody is losing under neoliberalism. You know, don't have jobs anymore. You've got gigs, right? Trump did not get the votes of the poorest people in this country. We know that. But he did get 77% of the vote of people who said that their economic conditions had gotten worse over the past 4 years. So there's a sense of falling, right? And then layered on that is this sense of losing other forms of status,
yes.
Right? The losing illegitimate forms of status,
right.
Power over
yes, others.
People of color, mm-hmm. over women, and Trump just mixes it all up and says, I'm going to bring back the good old days.
That was Joanne Hardesty with author and activist Naomi Klein. Expect to hear more of their conversation on an upcoming episode of Voices from the Edge. While state employees are known to receive great benefits, $291,000 in kickbacks is not supposed to be one of them. That's the amount that former State Energy Department employee Joe Colello, who managed the energy tax credit sales for the agency, pled guilty to accepting. Per court documents, Colello accepted 52 cashier's checks from Seattle-based energy consultant and tax credit broker Martin Shane. Shane was indicted last year on charges of forging documents to improperly receive nearly $12 million in energy tax credits to support new solar arrays at Oregon State University and the Oregon Institute of Technology. Most tax credit recipients chose to sell their credits to third parties at a state-mandated discount. Colello administered that program in 1 year, processing over $200 million in tax credit sales. The Oregon Education Association has cleared the first hurdle in their effort to have two new tax measures placed in front of voters. They've gained the 1,000 signatures required to receive ballot titles. And the first measure is called Initiative Petitions 26, and it would change legislative voting rules and allow tax measures on corporations to be passed by a simple majority. Currently, a 3/5 majority is required. The second measure, named Initiative Petition 27, would lower individual income taxes while simultaneously imposing a gross receipts tax on large corporations. The tax of slightly less than 1% would be applied to companies with annual sales in excess of $5 million. Last November, Oregon voters rejected Measure 97. That measure would have applied a much higher tax rate to a narrower range of businesses. The two initiatives come as the state continues to struggle with a $1.6 billion budget shortfall for this fiscal year. On Tuesday, the House of Representatives postponed a vote on this year's $8.2 billion K-12 education budget while they look for ways to increase the funding for schools. The top 3% of American earners stand to receive $660 billion in tax cuts under the proposed American Health Care Act, according to new analysis of Congressional Budget Office data. The CBO predicts 23 million people would lose health coverage under a bill recently passed by the U.S. House and currently moving through the Senate. Nearly 300,000 Oregonians would lose coverage over the next decade under the House version of the American Health Care Act. Eric Tegedov of the Oregon News Service has this report.
Oregon's millionaires could see an average tax cut of close to $40,000 a year if the American Health Care Act becomes law, according to a new analysis. Those tax cuts would be paid for in part by removing nearly 300,000 Oregonians from health insurance rolls. Alan Essig with the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy says data from the Congressional Budget Office confirms that the health bill that cleared the U.S. House is less about health policy than tax breaks for the top 3% of U.S. earners.
The end result is 23 million people losing healthcare coverage. The reason for that is to pay for $660 billion worth of tax cuts that overwhelmingly go to the wealthiest Americans.
Under the Affordable Care Act, low- and moderate-income Americans have been able to get coverage due to a tax on individuals making more than $200,000 a year, or $250,000 for couples filing jointly. Supporters of the AHCA say cuts to Medicaid and reversing the program's expansion would reduce the federal deficit and lower health care costs. Essig says the majority of Medicaid recipients that could be impacted by cuts would be the elderly, people with disabilities, pregnant women, and children. He adds insurance premiums for an average 64-year-old with an income of $27,000 would rise from $1,700 to more than $16,000 a year. Essig warns bankruptcies due to medical bills, which have gone down under Obamacare, could be back on the rise.
Real people will end up losing their health care coverage. That will impact people's health, people's lives, and people's bank books. We're going to be going back to where we were, which I don't think is where anyone wants to go.
The U.S. Senate has not made its version of the health bill public and has promised to bring it to a vote before the July recess. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The 2017-18 school year may be over in Oregon, but parents and students are still concerned about student safety throughout the Portland school system. A year-end incident at Hosford Middle School and the racial harassment of two teenage African-American girls that led to the knife attack on the Portland Max have only exacerbated these concerns, especially since many high school students in Portland ride the Max to class every day. Earlier today, KBOO's Ray Bodwell spoke to PSS Director of Media Relations Dave Northfield about security in our schools.
Back in March, Assistant Superintendent Antonio Lopez indicated that the school district was going to begin tracking racist incidents. Where does that stand? How did that go? You know, a little background on that.
So Antonio Lopez did say we will start tracking. He did say there are things happening. We need to start tracking it, which I think everyone in that building at PPS General Office, District Office, agrees with. We just need to go ahead and devote the resources to making that happen. Because if you anecdotally talk with the principals, for instance, at Hosford, and then for those who followed the news this year, there have been some unfortunate incidents at other schools that have been in the news. One at Grant with some racist graffiti. There have been some other incidents. So I think there are a lot of principals who would say there are things happening.
How would you broadly define the hate speech that it will track?
Well, that's a good question. And I think so that would need to be a conversation that we would need to have and come up with those definitions because, yeah, there are all sorts of ways that speech happens these days, of course. There is graffiti. There's person-to-person actual verbal speech. The largest growing category that the schools are dealing with and society is dealing with is social media. Mm. And so there are a lot of things happening on social media, not just regarding hateful speech, but actual threats. So the security division at the school district spends a lot of time investigating all of them because they all need to be taken seriously.
I know that there is a focus on security in the schools. Mm-hmm. How does it change by grade level?
So there are 25 security personnel within Portland Public Schools. Mostly those are located at the high school level, as you mentioned. There are two schools that service younger grades, Fabian, which is a pre-K through 8, and then King School. They have a full-time campus security person on site, but those are the only two. Now, there is a desire to increase that, and there have been proposals made by our director of security, George Weatheroy, to increase the number of people that are able to respond to situations at the school level. But unfortunately, as everybody else knows, this is not a great budget year. So the district is facing an $18 million shortfall. So this is not the year that that expansion will occur.
I know the school year is over, mm-hmm. but I know that in many school facilities, there are activities taking place all summer long. What happens differently from a security perspective over the summer?
Those security personnel are still on the job during the summer. And but obviously the need is reduced just because of the number of students in the buildings. So it's reduced proportionally to the number of students who were in programs during the summer. I know that in a couple of days there will be 1,500 students at Benson in summer classes, and those students come from all over the city, and I think sometimes they come from outside the city. But so there's that school is full. So there's obviously security devoted to Benson in the summer.
I think the incident that really kind of prompted me to reach out to you was the incident right before the end of the school year at Hosford Middle School.
The incident at Hosford. So that was a student who was at a bus stop near the school and was unfortunately the subject of some racially charged hate speech. A point of clarification, which is maybe important, maybe not important, but the student was not African American.
Oh.
But nevertheless was the principal told me the N-word was shouted, and so you know that student obviously was victimized by that speech, and was offered counseling and dealt with at the school level. I know you may be curious about how those incidents are dealt with when they occur off-site, so at a bus stop near the school. So in those situations, there are school resource officers who are Portland police officers, and I'd be happy to talk to you about those because I know that's a continuing topic of conversation among many people in the community about school resource officers. But they are sworn officers who are employed by Portland Police, who are stationed in schools. So the school resource officers, Portland Police, and TriMet Police would collaborate and respond to situations like the one that happened near Hosford Middle School at the bus stop.
Since you mentioned it, maybe you can explain to the listeners how the school resource officers fit into the whole thing, what their range of responsibilities are, and
right.
and you know how escalation occurs and so on.
Right. And there's been a lot of conversation this year. I don't want to pretend this hasn't happened, but there's been a lot of conversation this year, this school year, from the public about the appropriateness of having a sworn Portland police officer who is armed at a school site. I think if you talk to principals at the schools, especially the high schools, they would say that these are invaluable resources at the school level. These are officers who are specially trained in conflict de-escalation. They make very few arrests. These are police officers who express the desire to become a school resource officer. So they're interested in that age group. They're interested in those relationships. And so they want to be there. Another point that I'd like to touch on that you raised about parents and how they feel about their children going to and from school, and because many students, and in part because they receive this benefit from Portland Public Schools in the city and TriMet, they get a TriMet pass, and so they ride TriMet.
Right.
So there are no yellow buses to high schools in the city of Portland. For the next 2 years, Grant students will be, because their school is about to undergo a massive modernization, those Grant students will be attending classes on the Marshall campus.
Ah.
So many of those students will ride Max to get to class, and they will board Max at the Hollywood Station, which for a lot of people is
that will always be a traumatic location.
Will be a traumatic location. So the district is aware of that. TriMet is aware of that, and so we're very sensitive to the fact that people have some anxiety about that.
That was KBOO's Ray Bodwell with Dave Northfield, Director of Media Relations for Portland Public Schools. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for News from the Boo at 5:45, followed by What's Life Without Laughter at 6, and Free Culture Radio at 6:30. At 7 o'clock tonight, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather should start off with a low of 53 overnight, and then getting sunny with a high of 84 midday. East of the Cascades and Hood River, the high will be around 85. Today in history, in 1990, a 7.7 earthquake near the Caspian Sea in Iran killed more than 50,000 people and injured another 135,000. Our quote of the day is from birthday boy Jean-Paul Sartre, who said, "The best work is not what is most difficult for you, it is what you do best." The American Civil Liberties Union has filed a lawsuit against the District of Columbia Police Bureau for unlawful conduct at the Inauguration Day protests. Over 200 people arrested, while two of the protesters requested the suit. The ACLU claims that the police used aggressive force by deploying tear gas and flash grenades against journalists, legal observers, and peaceful protesters. The district's Metropolitan Police Department also kept detained protesters in rough conditions, restricting their access to toilets, food, and water. Many of the MPD's reports of misconduct are documented as official complaints. On Tuesday, officials released the police dash cam video of footage of the shooting of Philandro Castile by St. Anthony, Minnesota police officer during a 2016 traffic stop. The video, which does not have a view inside of Castile's vehicle, was released just days after a jury acquitted Officer Geronimo Yanez of all charges in the fatal shooting. In the video, Castile can be heard calmly telling the policeman, "Sir, I have to tell you that I do have a firearm on me." Castile was carrying the gun legally. Officer Yanez remains calm for a few seconds, but then quickly reaches for his service revolver while telling Castile not to pull his gun out. Both Castile and girlfriend Diamond Reynolds can be heard telling the officer that he is not reaching for his gun. But within seconds, Officer Yanez aims and fires 7 shots into Castile. Reynolds then began live streaming the aftermath of the shooting on Facebook. That video went viral and sparked outrage at what appeared to be another unprovoked police shooting of an African American. Officer Yanez was fired by the St. Anthony police after the incident, and he was charged with 3 felonies, including second-degree manslaughter. During the trial, he told jurors that he feared for his life. However, Ms. Reynolds said that Mr. Castile was simply reaching for his driver's license as he had been asked to do by the police officer. Since the acquittal, St. Anthony police have said that Yanez will not be rehired and will not be returned to duty. Earlier this year on Columbus, Ohio, a viral video showed a cop kicking a man in the head. The man who was kicked, DeMarco Anderson, was already in handcuffs and was face down on the ground. In the video, Officer Zachary Rosen walks into the scene delivering a swift kick to Anderson's head for no apparent reason. Police officials say the kicking of the suspect was an untrained technique outside of police policy and was unreasonable. Chief of Police Kim Jacobs recommends a 24-hour suspension. Officer Rosen has recently been cleared by a grand jury in the shooting death of Henry Green last summer. He said that he feared for his life. This morning, a man stabbed a transit police officer at the Bishop International Airport in Flint, Michigan. The airport was evacuated after the attack, and surrounding facilities increased security measures. The assailant was detained and identified as Almer Fatui, a Canadian national. The victim is in stable condition. The FBI is leading the investigation of this assault. Today's report from Climate Connections focuses on Illinois' new energy law that funds solar energy projects for low-income communities. Here's Dr. Anthony Leisowitz for more.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Illinois recently passed a sweeping new energy law that includes a program to help low-income people tap the benefits of solar energy.
It will fund incentives for rooftop solar projects in low-income communities. It will fund community solar projects where the subscribers are low-income households. And it will fund incentives for public facilities and nonprofits that serve low-income families to install solar.
That's Juliana Pino, policy director at the Little Village Environmental Justice Organization in Chicago, a group that helped negotiate the policy. The program will boost the number of rooftop solar systems and create local jobs in these neighborhoods. It also calls for training programs to prepare people in low-income communities for jobs in the solar industry. It even includes incentives to hire vulnerable people.
There is a goal for at least 2,000 jobs to be created for persons with a criminal record or alumni of the foster care system.
So the law will address environmental and social issues.
We really believe that access to clean energy that provides living wage, work, and wealth building is something that should happen everywhere.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Up next, Rick Smith presents a look at today in labor history.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1941. That was the day Ford Motor Company finally signed with the United Auto Workers. Ford was the last of the big three to sign with the UAW. The hard-won victory came after nearly three decades of struggle to organize there. Anyone attempting to build a union had been met with the full force of Ford's service department, led by Thug Harry Bennett. Intimidation, Jew baiting, red baiting, firings, and beatings were common in the years leading up to unionization. Some unionists had even been murdered. The company finally caved after a solid strike shut down production at the massive River Rouge complex in April. Several union committee members had been fired, and the UAW called a strike in their defense. Tens of thousands of black and white workers poured out of their departments to join the picket lines. They blocked all plant gates with their cars. Strike bulletins, press statements, and radio broadcasts kept workers updated on the latest decisions. A week into the strike, the NLRB ruled an election be held within 45 days. Strikers went back to work on guarantees that their co-workers would be reinstated. The following month, the UAW won union certification after 60,000 rallied in Detroit's Cadillac Square in support. When Ford finally signed the first contract, it guaranteed competitive wages, a closed shop, and dues checkoff. The first contract also ensured seniority rights, grievance procedures, and pensions. The union immediately took advantage of the contract clause that prohibited racial discrimination. They set up a commission to combat racism on the shop floor, issuing anti-racist literature and backing the elections of black committeemen and stewards. Labor historian Steve Babson notes, it was a watershed in American history.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a Diversified Media Enterprises production. I'm Doug Cunningham. Randy Bryce is an iron worker and labor union activist running for Congress against House Speaker Paul Ryan in the midterm elections. Bryce is a cancer survivor and sees firsthand the impact of health issues on his family and people living in Ryan's district in Wisconsin. This is an excerpt from Randy Bryce's video announcing his campaign against Ryan.
I'm the best person to represent this district because I'm a working person. If somebody falls behind, we're so much stronger if we carry them with us. That's the way I was raised. We look out for each other. I think it's time. Let's trade places. Paul Ryan, you can come work the iron, and I'll go to D.C. We can do so much better together as a community, and our future depends on it.
Paul Ryan happily celebrated House passage of an appeal of Obamacare that would result in 23 million more working people losing their health insurance. Bryce says seeing his mother deal with MS and his own battle against cancer in his 20s makes healthcare a very important issue for him, and he wants workers at that table in Washington, D.C. when those healthcare decisions are made.
I could do so much more, and I will do so much more, taking my voice, taking our voice, and what we need to Washington, D.C. I decided to run for office because not everybody's seated at the table, and it's time to make a bigger table.
Tuesday, striking port truckers at the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach joined a coalition of community, labor, and clergy leaders for a rally and march through Long Beach with elected officials. The strike is part of a long campaign by port truckers backed by the Teamsters to end misclassification of truckers as independent contractors instead of employees. The truckers are also demanding union rights. Fred Potter is a Teamsters vice president and head of the union's ports division. He says congestion and inefficiency
policy are also problems with trucking at the Los Angeles and Long Beach ports.
There's no incentive for the terminal operators or the port to operate efficiently because these guys, when they're misclassified, they're not paying for the time they're sitting there. We think that the movement to company employees is actually going to cause the port operators to operate more efficiently.
The Teamsters say American corporations have pushed tens of millions of American truck drivers, warehouse workers, and service sector workers into poverty through greedy subcontracting schemes designed to increase CEO pay. So the port workers and the Teamsters want to see these workers get unions and become company employees.
Brought to you by Blue Cross Blue Shield National Labor Office, empowering working Americans with stable health coverage for over 50 years. The National Labor Office is committed to remaining the top choice for the 17 million union workers, retirees, and families they serve. Online at bcbs.com/NLO.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
While the White House soap opera is drawing everyone's attention, Saudi Arabia made a change in its political structure that could increase the kingdom's military aggressiveness. King Salman just fired the crown prince, his nephew, Mohammed bin Naif, and made his son, Mohammed bin Salman, heir apparent. Bin Salman, the Saudi minister of defense, launched an air war against Houthi rebels in northwest Yemen in the spring of 2015, a war that continues today. He's displayed his hatred for Iran, increasing tensions with Yemen and Syria, fallen out with the Egyptian president, and is trying to stop the independence of neighboring Qatar. At 35, bin Salman is the first millennial in line to rule a nation. His father, King Salman, is 81. And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imalc.org for Tuesday, June 20th, 2017. Israeli troops kill a Palestinian man and detain five others during invasions targeting West Bank communities. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli soldiers shot and killed on Tuesday evening a young Palestinian man near Jabal military roadblock northeast of occupied East Jerusalem. The Palestinian Health Ministry has confirmed that the slain Palestinian has been identified as Baha Ahmad Samir Al-Harbawi, 23, from the town of Al-Izariya, east of Jerusalem. The Israeli army claimed that the soldiers killed the Palestinian after he attempted to stab them while they were conducting routine searches. The army also closed the area and isolated it while more troops were deployed around it, especially around Palestinian communities north of Jerusalem and in the northern part of the West Bank. In addition, the soldiers invaded Al-Izariya and abducted Imad Al-Harbawi, the father of the slain Palestinian, after storming his home and searching it, and took him to a detention interrogation center in Ma'aleh Adumim colony. The family denounced the murder of its son and the military allegations. Iyad Al-Harbawi, the uncle of the slain Palestinian, said Baha left Al-Izariya after finishing his work in the evening and told the family that he was heading to Ramallah to visit his brother and to do some shopping in the area. Baha was never detained and imprisoned by Israel and had no political affiliation. Elsewhere, Israeli soldiers abducted on Tuesday at dawn two young Palestinian men in the northern West Bank Governorate of Jenin and Bethlehem Governorate south of occupied East Jerusalem during house searches there. Moreover, Israeli soldiers abducted on Tuesday at dawn three young Palestinian men from the southern West Bank Governorate of Hebron and invaded many neighborhoods in the city and nearby towns. The soldiers invaded the towns of Sa'ir, Bani Na'im, Yatta, and Al-Rahiyya and installed roadblocks on roads leading to Sa'ir, Al-Zahriya, and Jorit Belhas area before stopping and searching dozens of cars and interrogated many residents while inspecting their ID cards. Late on Monday at night, the army invaded Sa'ir and clashed with dozens of local youngsters after the soldiers invaded homes in Al-Duwara area. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Tuesday, June 20th, 2017 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Hassan Badmura.
The Good Friday Agreement, a major peace deal between the United Kingdom's government, Northern Ireland, and the Republic of Ireland, is at risk of being violated since the UK's snap election. Here's more from Anne Garrison's Pacifica report.
Theresa May's Conservative Party lost their parliamentary majority in last week's UK snap election, but Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party surged, adding 30 more seats to their total. The only party that may be willing to strike a deal with the Conservatives that allows them to stay in power is the Democratic Unionist Party of Northern Ireland, or DUP, which won 10 seats. The DUP is a pro-UK Unionist Party whose defining issue is keeping Northern Ireland within the United Kingdom. British comedian Jonathan Pye summed up the DUP platform shortly after the election. Pye's comic persona is that of a British television reporter making offhand conversation with his producer just before going on air.
Oh, God, the DUP. I don't know anything about the DUP, Tim. I'm a Westminster correspondent. I don't know anything about Northern Irish politics. Northern Ireland may as well be f***ing Scotland, how much I give a f***. Yeah? But I have been reading up about the DUP, and they seem like quite a lot of fun. Barrel of laughs. From what I can make out, they have strong connections to paramilitary organisations. They're anti-abortion, pro-apartheid, anti-gay rights. So they sound nice. I mean, what a f*** up. What a f*** up. My question is, how can the UK government continue to act as a power broker in Northern Ireland when it's done a deal with one of the two parties? Northern Ireland hasn't exactly been politically stable of late.
Sinn Féin, a Republican party whose defining issue is the unification of Ireland as a republic independent of the UK, won 7 seats in Parliament. However, since its core principle is independence from the UK, Sinn Féin members have always refused to validate UK control over Northern Ireland by refusing to take their seats and the oath of allegiance to the Queen. They have, however, taken up their parliamentary offices in London and used them to lobby for their cause. It is extremely unlikely that Sinn Féin will finally take their seats, even for Jeremy Corbyn, and extremely unlikely that Corbyn will ask. However, if Labour were to strike a deal with Sinn Féin, they would run the same risk that Theresa May runs, putting them on one side of the Northern Irish conflict and violating the spirit, if not the letter, of the Good Friday Agreement. According to that agreement, codified by referendums in both Ireland and Northern Ireland, Northern Ireland remains part of the UK, but will become part of a unified, independent Ireland if referendums are held and both parts of Ireland vote for independence. Thus, the agreement transfers agency to the Irish people and obliges the UK government to act as an impartial broker between the pro-independence and pro-UK unionist sides. The Conservatives have not yet been able to finalize a deal with the right-wing pro-UK DUP, and many have warned that any such deal will not only violate the spirit of the Good Friday Agreement, but almost certainly lead to instability in Northern Ireland. With a hung parliament, meaning no overall majority elected, the UK government is expected to be fragile no matter what deals are struck, and it's very likely that another election will have to be held before the end of this year. In Berkeley, for Pacifica, KPFA Radio, I'm Ann Garrison.
You're listening to KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories. If you covered a local event and you have audio or video of that event that you'd like to share with us here at KBOO, we would like to hear from you. Call us at 503-231-8032 or contact the Evening News Director via email at newsdirector@kboo.org. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Dan Raphael, Ray Bodwell, and Jim Thompson. Our producer is Kyle Caresi. Special thanks to Joanne Hardesty, Oregon News Service, Labor Radio, Labor History, Climate Connections, the International Middle East Media Center, and Pacifica Radio. Our engineer is David Kesters. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelos Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, and you can also find us on Facebook or on Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR in Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Brian Pritchett. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7 o'clock, we've got Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Voices from the Edge with Joanne Hardesty, progressive talk radio from a grassroots perspective. At 9, it's Press Watch. Teresa Mitchell will bring you the news that you're not supposed to know. At 10 o'clock, hear Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on Between the Covers, Kathleen Stevenson welcomes Victoria Stopiello to discuss her collection of essays, This Side of Sand Island, Reflections on Fish, Fins, and Finding Out About the Lower Columbia. And at 11:30 on The Film Show, a visit to the new micro cinema at Portland International Airport, which features short films and videos by Oregon directors. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a current member, you can become one right now by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate.
And now it's time for News from the Boo, the weekly segment from people inside of and around KBOO, with news from your community radio station.
That's right, it is 5:45 on a Wednesday, which means it is time once again for News from the Boo, our weekly roundup of items of interest here in the station and the greater listening community. We are joined, as we often are, by station manager Gil Cardone.
Hey, Brian.
Hello. And today we are also joined by Ani Haynes, who is KBOO's volunteer and outreach coordinator. Hello, Ani.
Hello.
Ani, I understand that you are going to give us the lowdown on some really cool events that we've got coming up in the next 2 weeks.
Absolutely. We have a lot of things going on. This weekend, in fact, is going to be Good in the Hood. Good in the Hood is a wonderful multicultural music, art,